So the topic of this lecture, and indeed tomorrow's lecture, is capital structure, a key topic in financial management. So what is capital structure? Capital structure refers to how the company finances its activities. We can think of it as the makeup in terms of debt and equity. Now, the story in reality is more complicated than that, but as far as we're concerned in this module, there are only two broad brush categories of financing: debt and equity. So I want to start, not for the first time, by drawing a little cartoon. So my cartoon is a box. And whenever I draw a box in this context, that box represents a firm, a company. The size of the box is the market value of the firm. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean the market value of the firm's assets. The assets reflect the uses of the financing that the company raises. The company uses that financing to buy assets, which it then uses productively in the form of capital projects. That's how it adds value. The projects involving those assets are positive NPV projects. So the market value of the firm is a shorthand way of saying the market value of the firm's assets. And now the question I want to ask is, does it matter how those assets are financed? Does it matter what the precise makeup is of the financing? That's what we mean by the capital structure. Now, you have to remember that in finance, we're all about market values. We could also talk about book values, and indeed that's what accountants do. But we're not interested in book values. So you've got to be clear in your mind that throughout this lecture, and indeed the next lecture, and indeed the first lecture next week on dividend policy, whenever I talk about value, I definitely mean market value. So the question I want to pose today is, does it matter in terms of the company's overall value? Does it matter in terms of the size of this box? Does it matter how the assets are financed? Does the split between debt and equity matter? The ratio of debt to equity is given a name. In the UK, we call it gearing. That's the gearing ratio. In the US, they call it leverage. So two words meaning the same thing. And so the question I'm asking essentially is, does the debt to equity ratio matter? Does it matter from the point of view of how valuable is the company? Does it matter where I draw this dividing line between equity and debt? And again, to reinforce the message, when I write big E, I mean market value of equity. When I write big D, I mean market value of debt. And I hope it's now patently obvious to you that the market value of the firm's assets is the sum of the two. So in case there's any confusion, the market value of the firm's assets is the sum of the two. The V on the left-hand side of the equation I've just written, that's the market value of the assets, that's looking at the uses of the financing. The E and the D together that I've written on the right-hand side, that's looking at the sources of financing. And you should appreciate that sources must equal uses, unless there is some leakage to a third party. And in most of this lecture, and the next lecture, I'm going to assume there isn't. I'm going to pose for you a perfect world shortly, And we're going to study whether capital structure is important or not in a perfect world. And the work I'm going to present to you was first thought up and published in 1958 by two men called Franco Modigliani and Merton Miller. The latter, sadly, is now dead. Both Nobel Prize winners, although only Miller got the Nobel Prize for this work. Modigliani got it for something else. I'm often asked by students, why do you waste our time telling us about a model that was thought up more than 40 years ago and which only applies to a mythical perfect world which looks very little like the world in which we live? And the answer is to see what clues we can learn about why capital structure may be important in the real world, when, as we'll see, it's not important at all in the perfect world of Modigliani and Miller. In other words, we're going to try and pinpoint what is it that's different. What are the key differences between the real world in which we live and the perfect world of Modigliani Miller that might make capital structure matter? Or, as we say in the jargon of capital structure, might make capital structure relevant. Because if capital structure matters, then the senior managers owe it to the shareholders of the company to settle on the optimum capital structure. At the end of the day, as I've been saying since the very start of this module, the senior managers are charged with the responsibility of maximising shareholder wealth. The question I want to pose today and tomorrow is, does capital structure matter in the pursuit of shareholder value? Does it matter or not? And what we'll see is, in the perfect world of Modigliani Miller, it doesn't. Capital structure is irrelevant. But then we'll go on to look at reasons why, in the real world, capital structure might be relevant. And if it is relevant, the managers of the companies ought to be doing their best to operate their company with an optimum capital structure. That's the logic of this lecture and the next lecture. So that's the roadmap of what's coming. Let's just dive in. Now, you've got to be very careful in this lecture and the next lecture. You've got to pay particular attention to the variables that appear on the axes of different diagrams that I draw. Sometimes it will be more useful for us to think in terms of market value of the firm. But at other times, it will be more useful for us to think about cost of capital. These two variables are intimately and inversely linked. So before I say anything more, let's think the following image. We've done this before. Let's have in our mind a cash flow diagram. Now let's keep the story as simple as we can. So let's imagine that the cash flow diagram is made up out of a stream of expected future cash flows that carries on indefinitely into the future and for which all of the cash flows are the same size. So I hope you're already thinking he means a perpetuity. So to keep the maths as simple as possible, let's think of the situation in which the cash flows we have in mind, and I'll say a bit more about that in the next few minutes, that stream of expected future cash flows is a stream that goes on forever and ever and ever. The cash flows appear at regular intervals, shall we say once a year, and they're all the same size. So let's call that cash flow Big C. Have you got the diagram in your mind? Lots of upward pointing arrows, one period, two periods, three periods, etc., into the future, and all of the upward pointing arrows are labelled Big C. They're all the same. Now I'm going to tell you that the appropriate discount rate or cost of capital is Big R. And what you need to decide without hesitation is, what's the expression for the present value, that's the value today, of that stream of expected future cash flows? So all I'm asking you is to go back in your mind to the second lecture on financial arithmetic and remind yourself what's the formula for calculating the present value of a perpetuity. And the answer is, present value today is any one of those cash flows, we're calling them big C, divided by big R. So keep that equation in your head. The present value is another name for the market value today. So market value today, in the simplest of circumstances, and we'll keep it like that for our purposes today and tomorrow, in the simplest of circumstances, where the cash flows that are attributable to whatever assets we're talking about, whatever investment we're talking about, where the cash flows are all the same size and go on indefinitely into the future, appearing at regular intervals, market value today is given by one of those cash flows, big C, divided by the cost of capital, the discount rate, big R. So V equals C divided by R. And that's it. Because now you see immediately that market value today is inversely related to cost of capital, big R. Because big R sits downstairs on the right-hand side. We could look at more complicated cash flow streams, but we'd still come back to the conclusion that market value today is inversely related to cost of capital. Now let's be a bit more precise. If the investment I'm talking about is equity, so I'm looking at the equity part of that picture, the corresponding cash flows are the dividends. So, if I look at the story at the level of one share in the company, then the value on the left-hand side of the equation is the share price. The cash flows on the right-hand side of the equation are the dividends per share. Alternatively, I could look at the equity as a whole. In other words, I could multiply by the total number of shares. In which case, on the left-hand side of my equation is the market value of equity, and the cash flows on the right-hand side are the dividends in total, added up across all the shares that are paid every year. The question is, what's the discount rate? The discount rate is the cost of equity capital. So there's a matching principle here. If what we're talking about is equity, so on the left-hand side is the market value of the equity, another name for that you know is market capitalization. On the right-hand side, the cash flows are the dividends, and the discount rate, the cost of capital, is the cost of equity capital. So, market value of equity and cost of equity capital are inversely related. Now let's switch our attention to the debt piece of the financing. If we're looking at the debt part, the cash flows that matter are the coupon interest payments, because that's what belongs to the lender. That's what the lender receives. And in my model, where I'm keeping things as simple as possible, the loan is an infinitely long loan. It is of indeterminate length. It doesn't mature. Because if it matures, it just makes the maths a bit messier. So in my story, the loan is a perpetual loan. So the interest payments appear every year, forever and ever. Amen. So if the market value we're talking about now on the left-hand side is the market value of debt, the cash flows on the right-hand side are the interest payments to be made to the lenders. The interest on the debt. And the discount rate downstairs, I hope you've guessed it, is the cost of debt capital. So, something of a principle is beginning to emerge. Because now, I think we can appreciate the following. In this simplest of scenarios, where the cash flows are all of the same size and go on indefinitely into the future, and I labelled those C, present value, I'll just write V, you could write PV if you wanted, but the present value, we've agreed, is that, where big R is the discount rate, the cost of capital. And what I'm exploring with you now is this matching principle. So, if what I'm talking about is equity, then the market value of the equity is given by that. It's the dividend, the aggregate dividend. Aggregated, that means summed up over all of the shares. It's the dividend in aggregate divided by the cost of equity capital. Likewise, the market value... I've got to be careful here. So, because I tell you what, to avoid some confusion, let's not write D, let's write DIV. I don't want to get D confused with debt. Let's write DIV. So that's the aggregate dividend each period. The market value of debt, on the other hand, that's the coupon interest payment. I don't know if I want to write big C there or what. What really matters for my purposes is this relationship. It's inverse. So, when I look at my original cartoon, sometimes I'll find it useful to think in terms of the market value of the equity and the market value of the debt. Other times I'll find it more useful to think about the cost of equity capital and the cost of debt capital. So you've got to keep your eyes well and truly fixed on the axes in the different diagrams that are coming your way in the rest of this lecture and tomorrow's lecture. But hang on. I'm missing something, aren't I? Because I've already said there's a relationship between the market value of the assets of the firm, the market value of the equity, and the market value of the debt. Is there a corresponding relationship in terms of costs of capital? And there is. And you already know it. Have you seen something like this before? Have you encountered that particular combination of the cost of debt capital and the cost of equity capital? It's a particular weighted average of these two costs of capital. And the weights reflect the makeup of the company's overall financing, i.e. its capital structure. The weights reflect how much does debt account for as a fraction of the whole. That's this weight or factor. How much does equity account for the whole of the firm? That's this weight or fraction. We've met this combination before. We met it at the end of the cost of capital lecture, and I gave it a name. I called it the weighted average cost of capital. But now we can give it another interpretation. Just like the cost of equity is the rate of return that the shareholders demand from their investment in the company, just like the cost of debt capital is the rate of return the lenders demand on their loans, the weighted average cost of capital is the rate of return to demand on the company's assets as a whole. Now, we never call it this, but we could call it the cost of asset capital. We never call it that because the assets are on the uses side of the balance sheet. The weighted average cost of capital, it's a particular weighted average of the cost of equity and the cost of debt. The weighted average cost of capital is the rate of return to demand from the investment in the firm as a whole. In other words, it's the rate of return that the assets as a whole should require, are required to produce. So in some of the diagrams coming up, I might be talking about market value of assets linked to market value of debt plus market value of equity. Alternatively, I might be linking cost of equity, cost of debt, to weighted average cost of capital, and the weighted average cost of capital maps on to the assets as a whole. Cost of equity goes with equity. Cost of debt goes with debt. Those are the easy ones to remember. WACC, weighted average cost of capital, that goes with the assets as a whole. Keep that at the back of your head as we go through the story. The senior managers of the company are charged with the responsibility of maximising the value of the firm. Look at the cartoon on the hand-drawn slide. The job of the senior managers is to maximise the size of the box as a whole. And that's why, if capital structure matters, they had better think about it. And they had better decide what is the optimum capital structure. Because their job in life is to do whatever is best for the shareholders. So, senior managers of the company, their job is to make this box as big as possible with the assets that they have at their disposal. We're going to make an assumption in this module that will make our lives easier. You will relax that assumption when you go on to finance 2. So what is the assumption? The assumption that we're going to make for the rest of this module is that the debt piece is riskless. The reason the debt piece is riskless in our module is we assume that the company is always able to meet its interest payments in full and on time, and wear the debt of finite length to repay the debt in full, the face value of the debt in full. So there's no danger in our model, in our module rather, there's no danger of the company defaulting on any of its interest payments. The risk associated with the debt is assumed to be zero. So all of the risk associated with the firm's business activities, and what you should be starting to think about is the following. When I talk about the risk associated with the firm's business activities, risk is all about exposure to change. So I want you to start thinking in terms of this little cartoon and starting to ask yourself, what could make the size of the box change? Well, depending on what the company is doing with its assets, if things are going particularly well, then the size of the box will get bigger. The market value of the assets will get bigger. As the company uses these assets in positive NPV projects, the bigger the NPV, the bigger the value of the company as a whole, so the box would expand. Likewise, when the cash flows generated by the various projects contract, possibly because of changes in the economy, the size of the box will contract. So the market value of the firm can either grow, expand, or contract with changes in market conditions. What I want you to understand up front is that expansion or contraction in our model, in our module, applies to this piece. Because that's where all the risk is. The debt piece isn't going to change. That's what I mean by saying the debt is riskless. The market value of the debt won't change. All the interesting stuff is happening in terms of the equity piece. Now, do you see what's going on? When the company is doing well, it's the shareholders who benefit. The debt holders are just kept happy. It's a satisficing relationship. You keep paying the interest on the debt in full and on time, you keep the debt holders, the lenders, sweet. You keep them happy. You satisfy them. You don't let them down. But in the good times, where the value of the company expands because it's able to create additional value, all of that additional value belongs to the shareholders, because it's that part of the cartoon that's expanding. The debt piece is not changing. That's the good news. The bad news is that when things are not going so well, the company has to continue to keep the debt holders happy. How many times have I said to you already in this module that first in line for any cash handouts are the lenders? Woe betide any company that misses an interest payment. So they're fine in this module. The debt is riskless. When times are not so good, when cash flows from operations are reduced, when the value associated with those operations contracts, it's the equity piece that contracts. So at the risk of sounding stupid, what I want you to consider in your mind is a diagram. I just can't do it with the handwritten slide. I want you to imagine a diagram where the size of the box expands or contracts depending on how well the company's business activities are doing, but it's the equity piece alone that expands or contracts. The debt piece does not change because we assume the debt is riskless. Risk is another word for exposure to change, and there is nothing changing about the market value of the debt, at least not until you get to IB 236 Finance 2. Let's look at this simple example then. Let's try and put some numbers on the story. We're going to compare two companies, A and B. Now, to keep the maths simple, cash flow streams are perpetuities, as before. The business activities of these two companies are identical. You couldn't tell them apart in terms of their assets. You couldn't tell them apart in terms of the projects that they run that use these assets. Absolutely indistinguishable. And in particular then, they have the same operating income as each other. I hesitate to use that word income. I wish I'd used cash flows. I keep wanting to change the slide and I keep forgetting. So maybe you want to write cash flow there. There is nothing to tell these two companies apart in terms of their assets, in terms of what they do with those assets, in terms of the cash flows they generate from their business activities, and therefore in terms of their business risk. Absolutely identical. In fact, there's only one thing to tell these two companies apart, and that's how they finance their activities. They have different capital structures. The first firm, Firm A, is all equity financed. So the little cartoon in the case of Firm A, the box is completely filled with equity. In the case of Firm B, there's some equity and some debt. Now, I wanted to imagine the possibility of there being two different scenarios reflecting the health of the economy. So, in scenario one, business is doing rather well, and the activities of each company, the projects, are able to generate cash flows from operations of £1 million. So there's your perpetuity. £1 million at the end of year one, year two, year three, etc., etc., forever and ever, amen. That's in the good times. In the not so good times, the cash flows from operations are reduced to £800,000. Now that's true equally of Firm A and Firm B, because they're in exactly the same line of business with exactly the same sort of assets, doing exactly the same things with those assets. Let's look at the story from the point of view of Firm A. Can I remind you? Firm A has no debt. So there's no interest to pay on any debt because there ain't no debt. So the top line looks at the cash flow from operations. And in the good times, Fermi is able to generate 1 million, so every number in this table is in thousands of pounds. I haven't got enough room to write all the zeros. In the good times, operations generate 1 million pounds. In the not so good times, it's only 800 million pounds. 800,000 pounds, I beg your pardon. That's a drop of 20%. Not so good compared to good represents a drop in operating cash flow of 20%. That 20% could be thought of as a measure of operating or business risk. You might want to write that down. That 20% is reflecting how variable the cash flows from operations are. And that goes to the heart of how risky are the company's activities. There is no debt in this firm's capital structure, so there's no interest to pay. So all of this operating income, operating cash flow, is taxable. Let's assume that the companies pay corporation tax at 30%. You know, in the UK, the corporation tax rate currently is 28% for large firms, and that after April, the beginning of April, it'll drop to 27%. But in my pretend world, let's keep the arithmetic easy, because I can't do the arithmetic with more complicated numbers. Let's assume the corporation tax rate is 30%. So the tax bill, the corporate tax bill, is 300,000 in scenario A. It's 240,000 in scenario B. That money's lost. That money ends up in the pockets of the tax man. So what's left in the good times of 700,000, what's left in the not so good times of 560,000. Compare those two numbers, and again, we see that they represent a 20% drop. But there's a difference now. The numbers at the bottom of the table reflect cash flows that belong to the shareholders. We started the table with cash flows from operations. But the shareholders don't have a claim on all of those cash flows. There's somebody ahead of them in the queue. And that somebody's the tax man. In terms of what belongs to the shareholders, it's whatever appears in the bottom row. And what we see in this simple example is the level of risk that the operations are exposed to, the business risk, carries all the way down through the table to the level of the shareholders. So the level of risk associated with the shareholding is also 20%. That's not a big surprise, really, because for firm A, the assets are entirely equity financed. So if the level of risk associated with the assets, i.e. how variable are the cash flows that the assets generate, if that's 20%, it's bound to be the case that the equity in the company is also represented by 20% in terms of risk. So there's no surprise there. The surprise, perhaps, or the more interesting thing happens when we look at firm B. Now, this is something we can do together. So the story starts exactly the same. Identical business activities, identical operations, so no surprise there, a 20% drop in income, cash flow, from business activities, from the good to the not so good times. But now firm B has debt in its capital structure. I'm assuming that the debt pays interest at 10%, and I'm telling you that in my example, that amounts to an interest payment of 500,000. That's going to turn out to be 10% of 5 million. Never mind where that comes from. The key point, and you really do want to write this down, the key point is that the interest payment is the same size in both scenarios. The lenders don't say to the company, we see that things have not been so good for you. The economy is not behaving itself. Times are a bit harder. So what if we cut back on the interest payments? It doesn't work like that. The company is locked in to those interest payments regardless of how well or how badly it's doing. And as we're about to see, that hits. It's got to make an interest payment of 500,000 regardless. So what I want you to start doing now is fill in the table. The taxable income is whatever is left over after the company has paid the interest payment on its debt. Because remember, at the head of the queue for cash flow payments are the lenders. That's their cash flow payment, and we must make that. Next in line is the taxman. So the taxman will get a 30% share of whatever is left after the lenders have been fed. So let's fill in the numbers. 500,000 is left as taxable income, of which 30% goes immediately to the taxman in the form of corporation tax, leaving 350,000 for the shareholders. That's in the good scenario. Now let's quickly do the numbers again in the not so good scenario. Now the operating cash flows that we start with are only 800,000. Sadly, the interest payment has not changed. It remains fixed at 500,000. So what's left for the shareholders is only 300,000, of which 30% goes to the taxman as corporation tax, leaving for the shareholders 210,000. What I want you to do now is, it's not difficult, work out what is that as a percentage fall. In the good times, the shareholders are entitled to a cash flow of 350,000. In the not so good times, the cash flow they're entitled to is only 210,000. What does that represent as a drop? Is it 20%? No. It's 40%. In this simple example, these percentage drops are playing the part of a measure of risk. Now, it's a very crude measure of risk, but we don't really have a very deep understanding of risk, so we have to make do with these hand-waving heuristics. What I want you to see is, in the case of the firm that is entirely equity financed, that was firm A, in the case of the firm that's entirely equity financed, the 20% drop in cash flows from operations, so that's a measure of business risk, that translates all the way down to the level of risk that the shareholders are exposed to. In the second case, where, as it turns out, the firm is going to be 50% equity financed, 50% debt financed, that 20% business risk ends up as 40% equity risk. I wonder if you can see why when you look to this cartoon. The business risk represents how variable is the size of the box as a whole. The box that represents the market value of the firm, the market value of the firm's assets. That 20% business risk is being shouldered entirely by the shareholders. And in the case of firm B, it turns out, equity and debt each account for 50% of the financing. So all of the business risk in the case of firm A is shouldered by equity holders, shareholders, but the same level of business risk in the case of firm B is shouldered by the equity holders, but they're only half as big. So per unit of equity investment, these guys feel the risk more greatly. The reason this is 40% compared to 20% is the same 20% of business risk is being shouldered in the case of firm B by a shareholder body that's only half as big as in the case of firm A. Remember, we assume the debt is riskless. So none of the variability in the operating cash flows rests on the shoulders of the debt holders. It's only the equity holders. Now I want you to think about how the equity holders are going to view this situation. Think in terms of what rate of return will they demand from their investment? Well, you know now. You know from the cost of capital lecture that the higher is the level of systematic risk, The higher is the level of systematic risk, the higher is the required rate of return, big R. We can see from this little cartoon that the shareholders in firm B are going to demand a higher rate of return than the shareholders in firm A, because the shareholders in firm B are exposed to twice as much risk. Now, I can't say that the rate of return they'll demand is twice as big. And I can't say that for two reasons. One, remember our securities market line. Big R, that's the variable up the vertical axis, big R is not proportional to systematic risk. It's the excess rate of return that's proportional to systematic risk. The straight line doesn't start at the origin. It starts at the risk-free rate. So I can't say doubling the risk, doubling the systematic risk, doubles the rate of return. It doesn't. What doubling the systematic risk does is double the risk premium, the extra, over and top of the risk-free rate. But the second thing is, it's only systematic risk that's rewarded with extra return, and this isn't systematic risk. It's not completely systematic risk. So I can't say to you that the shareholders of firm B will demand twice the rate of return, but I can suggest to you that they'll demand a greater rate of return. So this leads us into the traditional view of capital structure. We are not going to do anything complicated in this module with equations and mathematics. We are going to draw pictures left, right and centre until we get the hang of the story. So this graph is very important. And if I can remind you, what you must do before you do any thinking or drawing is check the axes. The horizontal axis in this case is debt divided by equity. You might like to note down on the slide market values. Market value of debt divided by market value of equity. So that's the gearing ratio using market values. Up the vertical axis, cost of capital. There are always three costs of capital to think about. There's cost of equity capital. There's cost of debt capital. And there's your old friend, weighted average cost of capital. And all three can appear on the same diagram. Let's start simple. The debt is riskless. So you should be asking yourself, what's the required rate of return on the debt? What do the lenders demand as their rate of return? And you should know the answer. The risk-free rate. So you might like to write down at the left-hand side of this diagram that the height of the cost of debt graph is the risk-free rate, because we're assuming that the debt is riskless. And how do I know from the diagram that the debt is riskless? Because the graph is flat. It's flat and equal to the risk-free rate, doesn't change. Before I go any further, I want you to look back to this cartoon and understand the following, because this is often a source of confusion. As I move to the right in the diagram on the slide, as I move further and further to the right in terms of the graph, what's changing in this diagram is the position of the dividing line. As we move further and further to the right, more and more of the equity is being replaced by debt. It's a substitution effect. When we start at the left-hand side of the diagram, it's all equity and no debt. So the debt over equity ratio is zero. As we start to move to the right in this diagram, more and more of the equity is being replaced by debt. And what the diagram is telling us is what happens to the rate of return that the shareholders demand. And we've already got a clue as to what that is. Because as we introduce debt into the capital structure in place of equity, as you saw from the simple numerical example, the risk that the shareholders are exposed to gets bigger. So the rate of return they demand gets bigger. And that's what this graph is suggesting. That the cost of equity capital continues to increase as we replace more and more equity with debt. The question is, what happens to the weighted average cost of capital? And the answer is, as I've shown you on the graph. Now, we'll pick up with this tomorrow, but before I stop, can I just highlight for you the key point? The graph of the weighted average cost of capital in this traditional view of capital structure is U-shaped. There's a minimum. A minimum value for the discount rate, that's the weighted average cost of capital in this case, corresponds to a maximum value for the assets of the firm. So what this diagram is suggesting is, yes, there is an optimum capital structure. It's the ratio of debt to equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital, because that's the same thing as maximizing the market value of the firm's assets. And the market value of the firm's assets is just another way of saying the market value of the firm.